Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Sequelizers. What once was the show about fixing bad sequels to good movies, it's another spin-off episode this time. And since it is Mr. Stuart Ashen's swan song, we're going to be discussing some video game movies we wish existed. I'm your host, as usual, Jack Chambers, and joining me, Mr. Alexander Plowman.
Hello.
Mr. Stuart Ashen.
Hello.
Timothy Matem.
It's-a me.
And Matthew Stogden.
I got nothing.
You never do, Matthew. You never do.
Sometimes I do, and everyone regrets it. So
you either have nothing or too much.
Yep. The Stogden way.
So as I mentioned, we're going to be discussing some video game films we wish existed because, I mean, our specialty is shit films here. And, there's been a lot of bad, really bad video game movies.
Someone argued lots that of good ones. No way.
Someone argued there hasn't been any good ones, There's an argument to be made there for no such thing as a good video game film. I mean, we've talked about them in potential sort of sequelizer territory, like the Street Fighter franchise and stuff like that. Because the Mortal Kombat films, there's a lot of garbage. The Angelina Jolie Lara Croft films.
I think there's a lot that people have affection for. Like, I would look back at the Mortal Kombat films because I watched them when I was like 11 and be like, yeah, they're great, but they are not good films.
So I guess the question then is, why aren't video games good films?
That's a very good question.
Well, a lot of them are just bought as a cheap license and they knock out some old shit with the same name on. Dead or Alive, Tekken, etc., etc. Alone in the Dark. In fact, I could probably keep going for about a week and only mention Uwe Boll films. But yeah, and the other thing is, it's always hard to adapt that narrative of very, very long things happening for 35 hours thing into 2 hours. And filmmakers like to change all the details as well, often into things which don't work.
You've got a lot of kind of more cinematic experiences in video games now as well, especially with companies like Naughty Dog making the Uncharted series and The Last of Us and stuff like that. They're almost films with a bit of gameplay kind of sprinkled in there. And then you even get things like the Telltale games where it's almost no gameplay and mostly storytelling. Those would translate well into films, but they're also basically films anyway, so why would you bother? Because one of my thoughts when I was first talking to you guys, like, oh yeah, this is a great idea, I was like, oh, I'll do Uncharted. Oh shit, first of all, it's already in production, and second of all, it's sort of in production hell, and third of all, does it work? We've already got four Uncharted movies, five Uncharted movies, six Uncharted movies, depending on how many games you want to count. And it's like, they're basically films anyway with some shooting sections in between.
Is part of the problem not that video games, at least traditionally, part of the appeal is not necessarily the uniqueness of the narrative, but the idea that you are taking part in a narrative that you are quite familiar with, but that gives you agency as the protagonist. So, for example, Tomb Raider is a cliched Indiana Jones-style adventure movie in a video game. Resident Evil is a George Romero zombie movie in a video game. And by the time you try and adapt these things into films, you end up with something that, while it felt very unique in the video game world, feels less so in the cinema world because we've already seen that. And adapting it to a different medium, you lose the uniqueness and end up with something you've already seen before.
Yeah, I think like so much of video games is about the interactive nature of them. And it's about, we mentioned how, you know, a video game can be, you know, 35 hours long, if not, you know, longer. You take something like a Final Fantasy game and you're talking 200 hours, you know. And it's about those narrative loops and those things that keep you make you keep playing. But that is a completely different kind of language to what you have in film. And trying to take what makes a video game work and convert that over to a film can sometimes like completely strip out what is actually enjoyable about it and what people are going to it for.
And often, I think the problem with some games is they do want to try and be a film on some level. And this usually comes across with some insufferable expository cutscene that comes across like a sub-Zed movie that they should be lampooning on Mystery Science Theatre 3000. And you can get loads of these in a game. And if it's short and it's a bit campy and doesn't really make much sense, you can kind of get away with that in the game world. But even the short ones, when you try and turn it into an actual narrative, a real film, it's just not going to work, is it?
Yeah, it's a combination of extended... I don't think it's even extended. I think it's more just drawn-out character development. So some of the developments in video game characters, think, oh, well, they reveal these amazing plot points that go on for so long. It's like, no, that's just padding and filler that you enjoy because of the puzzle element or the gameplay element or whatever it is in the actual game itself that makes you, you know, continue playing. But at the same time, I think you guys are right ultimately that the most video game characters, even a really fleshed out one in a more cinematic style gameplay like The Last of Us or something like that, is still going to have a bit of a hollow shell of a person outside of those cut sequences, because you want the player to invest in the, you know, project themselves into that character, at least do something that can say, you know, I can play this through and imagine it's myself. But again, when you start trying to hammer out, well, hang on, if we're making an actual character who has an actual arc for a cinematic purpose, you have to define those things and nail them down. Not what an audience thinks it's. Even like if you take Assassin's Creed, because I always will, you've got like a character who spanned over three different games, Ezio, for example, big fan favorite. Tons of development there. But if you tried to create that into a character, even with all the backstory elements, even with everything that's happened to him and the various characters' interactions, he would probably have maybe five defining traits. It would down to the sort of at different ages, depending what is. It's all down to the story that drives him, but he has a few, you know, arc changes as a character. But if you were to try and write that as a character in a screenplay, it doesn't translate very well.
Do you think that part of the problem with this is also that there are lots of video games, but only a very limited pool of video games that are up for adaptation, because so much of this is about recognizable brands, which means going for AAA titles. Do you think that it is that there's actually a limited pool of selection for games, and that those AAA games don't necessarily lend themselves? Because, Jack, you were saying about Telltale. But the interesting thing there is that Telltale make games that are kind of a niche thing, relatively, in video game terms. I mean, they're popular, but they're not.
Well, they went out of business, so yeah.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Obviously, but weren't doing too well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly interesting things going on in sort of your indie games scene, and obviously with stuff like Steam that has exploded over the past, you know, 10, 15 years. But I think a lot of the places where it's getting more experimental, they're often more pushing at the boundaries of kind of like how you interact with a game and stuff like that, rather than necessarily... I think when you get indie developers and smaller titles and stuff like that, they're more interested in making a really great game than necessarily crafting a story that's going to turn into a franchise. Mm. Like, I think it, in some ways, yes, it is a shame that it's only the AAA games that get adaptations, but it kind of also makes sense because they're the ones that have gone, like, we want to be a blockbuster, like, both as a game and as a cultural phenomena. You know, again, that doesn't always pass. You know, you can take something like Super Mario, like, arguably the biggest character in gaming, one of the most popular franchises, but like, you could not make obviously we have seen one failed attempt at the Super Mario game. And even like the people who are making, because there's a new one in development, I think, and they've basically held their hands up and gone like, yeah, there isn't really a story to Super Mario.
There's some characters and a setting.
Yeah.
And we say characters, they exist visually.
There are people.
I guess essentially your option there is that you're using those characters then as a shell to put whatever story you want onto.
What colour's the shell?
I thought it was a Portal reference.
But you're using... You're using those characters as a vessel to...
Blue vessel.
Nerds. You're using those characters to project a story onto, and that then becomes a problem, because if everybody else has been doing that, and then you get, oh, your story was not at all my story. Why is Sonic so smart alecky? I thought Sonic was meant to be cutesy. In my mind, he had this voice. In my mind, he didn't sound like Danny DeVito at all. You know, that's the...
Well, he does in mine.
Yeah, that's the most like the Mass Effect argument. Because it's like, well, you can play either the Renegade option or the Paragon option. It's like, well, if you've only ever played it a certain way and suddenly a film says, this is now canon, you're very much being almost betrayed in a way by the thing. But also that's part of the problem with producers. Well, they sort of favor AAA games because companies and production houses and studios will say, what are we going to make it like a franchise out of? And what are we going to make, back to our cinematic universe mindset, what are we going to, you know, spawn something that's going to go on for ages and ages? Same thing with comic book properties. It's like, is this something we can go back to and drill down for again and again? Not the novelty of like, this is a pretty good standalone piece. It's like, are we going to be able to make tons of merchandise from this and tons of sequels?
Given that we seem to be in agreement that there haven't been any good... video game films, what do we think are the most successful, even if they've failed?
Assassin's Creed, you're going to fuck yourselves.
Mortal Kombat, the first one, I would say.
Is it just for the title? Music?
I mean, yeah, but I think it was just... It's kind of a daft movie, but I think that it's... And essentially, it's a... In some respects, it's a PG-13 remake of Enter the Dragon, but with monsters in it. But that's essentially...
That's an elevator pitch and a half. You know,
but given that Mortal Kombat leans so heavily into that kind of stuff anyway, it's like, for what it is, it's fine. It's not an amazing film, but it kind of works. It goes off the rails for the second one for all kinds of reasons, but that just about holds it together. Like I said, not a great film, but an acceptable film.
Yeah, I mean, it's nonsense and it's campy nonsense, but it knows it's nonsense. It's not trying to suddenly hit you with, oh, wait, but now you must feel emotionally invested in the story of Sonya Blade's dead child or something. You know, it's not trying to be a proper film. It's like, here's some fucking weird monsters and some loud noises. Enjoy.
Mm. Mortal Kombat knows it's campy nonsense.
Yes.
And I think that
the game
its
does,
film
yeah, absolutely.
Does the same thing.
But so does Street Fighter, and that was shit. Like, so shit.
Street Fighter's... Oh, I don't know. What makes that different? That's the question.
Yeah.
That's the question.
I feel like Street Fighter takes itself a little bit more seriously than... Is it at least the fans take it a lot locations? More seriously, I feel.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, it's still... I think it's aware how stupid it is because it's a very colourful, bombastic, silly thing. And Raul Julia, who is the best thing about that film, without a doubt, he's very much well aware of what's going on. He's properly chewing the scenery in a beautiful way. But... No, I think they knew what they were doing with it. But equally, it just didn't sell with us because I think it was too bright. And it sounds silly, but because Mortal Kombat feels darker, it's like, dark and silly. You're entering the sort of trauma territory. This is that feels appropriate for some reason.
I think there's an argument to be made that also the problem with Street Fighter is that it put Guile as the central character.
Yeah.
And made clearly, in Belgium.
Clearly should be Ryu. Like, you know, I feel like... The Mortal Kombat film mostly got that right? Like,
no, I think it got the character dynamic pretty
The thing with Mortal Kombat is, as well, you keep the simplicity of, here's some people, they all get together and have a big fight.
Yeah.
And you really want the good guys to win or Earth is fucked. It's nice and simple. Mm. And there's Raiden hanging around, that kind of stuff. Whereas Mortal Street Fighter, my God, I mean, like, Chun-Li's like a reporter and Balrog's nurse and so's E. Honda. He's not Japanese, he's Hawaiian or something. And then you've got Bison and his guys. And then they just try to shoehorn everything in. Every character's got to try and do something and none of it works. You
fucking
just end up
Blanca,
like this big, oh, man. Blanca. Charlie Blanca in that version. Rather than Jimmy Blanca
Charles
from
Blanca.
The Capcom game.
Hi guys, it's Alec here. I just wanted to make a quick interjection. While I was editing this episode, I realized that I'd not actually watched the Mortal Kombat movie for about 15 years. I decided that I was going to go back and give it a rewatch. And after having rewatched it, I realized that I have completely misremembered this film. While I say that it's an acceptable PG-13 version of Enter the Dragon, it really isn't. It is a steaming pile of garbage. And I just wanted to correct myself there because I think that to say that is kind of an insult to Enter the Dragon, and to make a claim that Mortal Kombat is remotely any good in any way was a mistake on my part, misremembered by my 14-year-old self.
Anyway, I might come back and do some kind of discussion about this at some point, talk about Mortal Kombat in some form. So if you want to hear that, you know, let us know in the comments and all the rest of it. Anyway, back to regularly scheduled Sequelizers content.
So I think we can all agree that we've solved all the problems with video game movies, and the problems are all the characters in films have to be well-defined. The more well-defined a player character is in a video game, the less invested you will be in it and the less you can imprint on it. Hooray.
Mm.
Money, please, Hollywood.
going back to my question of what have been video game adaptations that work, I'm going to raise the point, and it is by no means like an original thought that I have had. It's something that I've seen several people say, is that Scott Pilgrim versus the World, even though it's not based on a video game, it uses the video game
elements and surroundings. Yeah.
The elements, the language of video games to better effect than most video game films do.
The problem with that, though, is that it does so in a very knowing way, and in a way that it's playing with conventions that it assumes its audience is familiar with.
Yeah.
I don't know if a video game movie could do that. I don't know if a video game movie could turn around and be like, oh, we're self-aware about the fact that we're jumping on boxes and stuff's coming out and, you know.
You would need a video game that was already self-aware. You'd need something like
Duke Nukem.
Yeah, Duke Nukem.
Conker's Fad for the Day or
something like that.
Very briefly, I was just going to say, one that's sort of self-aware, but not really, was Doom. As I don't like Doom as a film at all, but that first person scene, it tries and you're like, stop it. But
rubbish. Oh, it looks like Doom for like 4 seconds.
And then you're like, no, make it stop. But there's another film, which I won't talk about too much because it might be complete spoilers because it's only just come out, but it's called Serenity with Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway.
And that's an interesting one,
but I can't talk about it because it will ruin things for people because it's a shit film, but a really ridiculous premise.
It's the twist, isn't it?
Yeah, read the Wikipedia page, because that take, again, speaking of...
Go and see the film. Read the Wikipedia.
No, don't fucking see the film. I encourage these people. But, you're talking like Scott Pilgrim, for example, and video game elements and surroundings and environment. That's very much one to analyze from a contextual point of view. But, terrible film.
Trying to think of what a po-faced, non-self-aware Scott Pilgrim would be. I think that's dangerously close to Ready Player One.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. As soon as you said that, Tim, I was like, oh, fuck, that's Ready Player One.
Yeah.
One that take a thing that knows all about video games but doesn't work. Aha! We've already got one of those.
Still liked it more than the book. Then again, I like being ill more than the book.
I like clawing my eyes out with rusty spoons more than Ready Player One. No, it's a bad Scott Pilgrim. So why don't we try and come up with some good ideas then, gentlemen? Should we... put our monies where our mouths are, I suppose, and see if we can pitch things to each other and see what we can come up with.
Let's do it.
And, Alec, I'll come to you first. Cool. What's your plan for a video game movie that you'd like to see?
Okay. The video game movie that I would like to see made is based on a Capcom franchise.
Okay.
That
good start.
Started in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. That does narrow it down.
Was sort of a spin-off from an existing franchise in that it took mechanics established and used them in a different context.
Is it going to be Typing of the Dead?
I was hoping for Darkstalkers, but I'll take Typing of the Dead.
So much teasing.
That game is Dino Crisis.
Good Lord.
And I'm keeping the title before anybody.
Oh, no, I would assume you would, yeah.
I think that the thing with Dino Crisis, the reason Resident Evil doesn't work being adapted into a film is because it is so indebted to a cinematic language already established in things like George Romero zombie movies. And I think that it's very difficult to make a Resident Evil movie that isn't just that, but done not as well. The thing with Dino Crisis is that Dino Crisis presents something that I don't think we've really seen, which is R-rated blood and guts horror version of Jurassic Park. And part of me thinks that that would be really fun.
I don't want to interrupt your pitch too much, but I was this close to doing Turok Dinosaur Hunter.
Yes.
Because I had basically the same thought.
Is that how you set up the cinematic universe? As the end, you see Turok pick up his knife out of the dead on dinosaur.
It's the dino gore, though, right? I mean, that's what you're selling it on.
And it's the fact that the Jurassic Park films have stopped working because they work on that thing of wonder, and we've kind of run out. They don't try and do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so you should just ratchet up like the horror and the action and make it a full blown action film.
Yeah. And you'd keep it fairly schlocky because the Dino Crisis games lend themselves to that, as do the Capcom.
Well, like we're saying, turning something that's kind of funny and self-aware into something deadly serious just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the other way around. So yeah.
So it would
keeping the tone makes sense.
Yeah, campy, tongue-in-cheek kind of thing. It would have a low budget, an almost sort of grindhouse vibe to it.
Mm.
But I think that if you really leaned into that, and I mean, depending on how you want to go, I think there's two ways you could do it, actually. You can either go really grindhouse, or you can go really lean, mean, low-budget horror
dog
premise. Yeah, you can either go Neil Marshall. There's the Neil Marshall.
In case you didn't catch that, listeners, the whole room went, at the same time.
Yeah, you can either go down the Neil Marshall route, or you can go down the Robert Rodriguez route. And either of those, you can have your schlocky, ridiculous dinosaurs movie with the crazy kind of B-movie effects and things, or you can have And I mean, Dog Soldiers is a bit schlocky in places, but it's fairly taut as a movie. And I think you could make either of those work. And how many elements you keep, because correct me if I'm wrong, I've not played Dino Crisis in years, but the dinosaurs are time traveling. Is that the thing at the end? Is they've built like a time portal?
Jesus, I don't remember at all.
I assume you were going to know this because Dino Crisis.
I've played both of them and I don't fucking remember.
But if you want to go schlocky, then you can keep that in. If you want to go a bit more serious, you can leave that out. But it gives you some scope. You could have a lot of fun with a Dino Crisis movie, I think.
I thought it was interesting you said about R-rated because my man is like, oh shit, you can have real problems because dinosaurs outside of Jurassic Park don't usually work very well. They don't, at least if you think about it, they've got equivalent, you've got Godzilla, the Emmerich version. You've got King Kong, the Jackson version. But I'm saying they're like mainstream dinosaurs outside of Jurassic Park franchise that's done well. But as stupid as it sounds, now Neil Marshall's in the discussion. I'm like, I'm on board.
I think just precisely because that's not something that we've seen. It just struck me when thinking about it, is Dino Crisis is kind of unique because I've never seen an R-rated dinosaur movie before.
No.
Mm. And then my question was why? And I'm assuming it's because Hollywood doesn't make them because dinosaurs sell really well to kids.
Yeah,
kids really like dinosaurs. So they're like, we have to make a dinosaur movie that the ages 5 to 11 aren't going to be excluded from because that's part of our demographic.
But dinosaurs are scary.
Yeah,
so that's stupid.
They're really scary. And if you've read the original Jurassic Park novel as well, now that's a hard R as far as the rating goes. And it's really interesting how Michael Crichton adapted that into the Jurassic Park script. Yeah. I think he wrote the script, didn't he?
I'm pretty sure he adapted it, yeah.
Yeah, because it's a very different thing. And when you read that book, you then get a sense of, oh yeah, R-rated dinosaurs could work and be really terrifying and we could do really fun, gross things with this.
Mm.
So yeah, that to me seems like a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's just occurred to me actually, kids love dinosaurs. We are all fully aware of this, but it's rare the dinosaur stuff actually works for them. You've got Jurassic Park, Land Before Time.
Mm.
Then you've got things like Disney's Dinosaur, the one nobody remembers.
That's shit.
And what was the recent one? The Good Dinosaur.
Yeah,
Dinosaur.
Yeah.
Was that actually Pixar?
Yeah, that was quite good.
And yet made no impact.
Yeah, nobody cares about it.
It's because it came out the same year as another Pixar that was
Inside
Out,
wasn't it?
Yes,
Inside Out. That was it. Yep.
But also, remember, I think We're Back, A Dinosaur's Story with John Goodman,
oh
I want to say.
Oh, my God.
1990-something.
Well, the TV show man, Dinosaurs.
That's a deep reference.
Dinosaurs TV show. That's a good show, to be fair.
Just The Simpsons in rubber suits. Denver, The Last Dinosaur. Dino Saucers, all your 80s non-classics.
Yeah. God.
Dino Riders.
Dino Riders, to be fair. Dino Riders was going to be my cinematic franchise thing before.
Cadillacs and Dinosaurs.
I remember that.
There's one for you.
You shouldn't have asked.
Part of it might also be, of course, that Jurassic Park has set a pretty heavy precedent to follow.
Very true.
I think how you, and it was what has been said earlier, which is Jurassic Park really inspired wonder and how you do that again. It's difficult to make a wondrous dinosaur movie after that. That's a thing that the Jurassic Parks themselves struggle with.
So that's the point. You turn that, you say, pull the plug on the wonder and just go, well, fuck you then. We're going to scare the shit out of you then.
Do you guys forget that they've got teeth?
Yeah.
They've got teeth. Yeah. They're going to bite you.
Yeah.
I feel like the opening scene of Jurassic Park with the, like, the
Shoot her!
Yeah, the raptor in the cage is very kind of Dino Crisis. That's very horror-y.
Yeah.
And then again, when the raptor is chasing Dr. Sattler down the corridor and she's like closing the gate behind her and it's just
the severed arm on the...
Exactly.
Could just really go full pelt on that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
it's, like, distill those bits of Jurassic Park into, like, a lower budget kind of corridor horror type stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's like they... They're all manufactured in a science facility, and you're right, it is like time travel. There's a theory that there's a warp in the space-time continuum and all this kind of stuff, and I think it's ever actually confirmed which one it is until later on in the series, and I think it is time travel, or like they've been experimenting with some other energy source or something, and it's caused a rift in the space-time
and
continuum.
And then dinosaurs showed
because
up.
And then dinosaurs, yeah, exactly.
I know we're talking about the idea of protagonists and, you know, projecting onto protagonists. I remember very distinctly the red hair and the bodysuit. I don't remember the name of the character from Dino Crisis.
Regina.
That's it. Regina.
Regina. Correct.
So would you keep that sort of character, or would you go with like a team, or what would
No, I'd keep the character. I think it just adds a lone to the kind person, of the horror craziness.
Element. Yeah.
And I think, again, the idea, if you wanted to go full schlock, that at the time, that kind of works now because it's so dated. Mm. Like 20 years on.
Well, Halloween's back and fucking Child's Play back, so it makes sense that you could bring that kind of schlock back. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it would feel very 90s. You could make it feel kitschy in 90s and do a kind of 90s schlock, 90s straight to video grindhouse kind of thing.
I'm just now picturing like the assault on Precinct 13, but all the gang members are dinosaurs.
See, that's there pretty you good. Go.
Yeah. Like, again, this is okay. Assault on Precinct 13, directed by Neil Marshall. I'm just thinking of who could play that role that isn't Scarlett Johansson.
Well, I mean,
that's the first thing the studio
funny
would say.
Thing is like, no. She was miscast, I think, in the Resident Evil series, but it would be Mila Jovovich, wouldn't it? Would be a.
Isn't she now doing Monster Hunter?
I think she is. Yeah,
a Monster Hunter film which has nothing to do with the game series at all.
That's classic,
but like
getting
frighteningly
it wrong.
So, because this game series is all sort of crazy, slightly anime-inspired medieval monsters.
It's very hefty,
and the films. Stills released so far have people in modern military gear with rifles leaning against a Humvee in a desert.
Oh, God.
Fucking hell.
But other
than that... Welcome to video game adaptations.
Yeah.
It fucking looks sums like they, it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, they nailed exactly everything we said you shouldn't do.
Take everything out of the original and just turn it into some modern fucking Zack Snyder
bollocks.
Why
even pay for the license?
It's got to be focus groups. It's got to be focus groups basically saying... what do you like about this game? Don't know about it. Well, would you like this? Yeah, let's do that instead. Do you like Mila Jovovich? Yeah. Do you like dinosaurs? Problem solved. Dino Crisis.
I would like to brutally murder anyone who's been in a focus group and stick their head on a pike as a warning to others, which would then stop other people.
They're going to be people
forming focus groups.
They're the people that are fed to the dinosaurs in Dino Crisis.
Oh.
That's a Rodriguez move.
That's a bit very Rodriguez meta, like. Yeah.
Using new facial capture technology, it puts the faces of the audience in the test screening on the victims.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, casting Dino Crisis is a weird one. I'm always more kind of reticent to ask who's doing the special effects. Like, how are you doing these dinosaurs? How are you getting
practically,
these?
I think. And I think it would need to be Jurassic Park style.
Yeah.
Animatronic kind of. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't get Stan Winston to do it now because he's no longer with us. But Alec Guinness and Tom Woodruff Jr., who did the Alien and Predator stuff, are always a good shout for stuff like that. But it would have to be practical.
I think they're right. A practical with a hint or an element of CGI to do certain things would be good.
A little Jar Jar Binks riding each of them.
That's all I'm asking.
Dino Crisis. I think it could work. I'll write a dinosaur movie. That's going to be a lot of fun. A big gory mess that could either be lean and mean or just balls out crazy. But I think if you go down that route, you're going to get a fun film. And that's kind of what you need from a Dino Crisis.
Fair enough. Tim, I'm going to come to you next.
Ooh.
What's your choice, sir?
So I have gone for something of a cult game from came out in the year 2000 from a developer who were probably better known for making the games MDK and the Earthworm Jim series, Shiny, and the game is called Sacrifice. And it was a sort of a real-time strategy game, but quite different to your others of that era of your Command and Conquers and your Shogun Total Wars. You controlled a character called Eldred, who was a wizard, who had was basically in the kind of the game story was a sort of a tyrant from another world, and was about to be overthrown and summoned a demon to try and get rid of his the kind of the rebellion that risen up against him, and instead it destroyed the world, and so he's kind of been cast out into the space between dimensions or whatever you want to call it, and landed on this world that's these weird floating islands that are overseen by these five different gods.
This is deep lore already, and I'm enjoying it.
And the game is essentially you working for these different gods and deciding kind of who you're going to favor in each mission, and slowly building up a roster of different troops based on the gods that you pick, and the plot kind of unfolds from there, and eventually the demon that you unleashed comes back and tries to destroy this world, and one of the gods turns out is actually like betraying and works with the demon and stuff like that. I came to this selection because I was thinking about what works translating video games into films, and we've said how plot doesn't really work because video game stories take place over a long period of time but don't necessarily actually have much story to them. This has got the decent underpinnings of at least the start of a story, and throw in some twists and some more supporting characters and stuff, and you probably get a decent film there about kind of redemption and stuff like that. But the thing that I think it really has is it has a fun tone. It's quite a kind of wry, a little bit self-aware tone, as you would expect from that publisher who, recently funny games and stuff like that. But it also has this amazing world. It has these completely bonkers environments that are all these floating islands, and the creatures that are in it that you gain with each, as you progress through the game to be parts of your army. Some of them are based on traditional fantasy creatures, dragons and stuff like that, but even the ones that are based on your ogres and trolls and stuff like that have very unique designs. And then there's also completely like bizarre creations, things like giant flying brains with like angel wings and stuff like that. It was a game where the design elements leapt out to me, and thought you could create a really fascinating world that isn't like something else that has been seen on, necessarily on cinema. Alec was saying earlier about how, so many of these video game worlds, especially your AAA titles, when you think about them, they are just stuff we've seen in movies turned into an interactive narrative. And this feels like a world that isn't necessarily, there's elements of fantasy in there, but it's a very unique take on fantasy. And it also has, it has the five gods, who are all relatively interesting characters, if quite archetypical. It's especially notable that the god of Earth basically looks like Earthworm Jim in a pair of dungarees. And they all have these like grand names like Persephone and Charnel and stuff like that. And then
isn't one of them Tim Curry?
Yes, that was something I was going to get to. And then the god of Earth is just called James. it has a great voice cast. It has Tim Curry as the voice of evil, of course. Brad Garrett, who's in like Everybody Loves Raymond and stuff like that. He's the voice of James. And it's this very just like prosaic, like, oh, how you doing, buddy? it has this incredible world. And then I was thinking about like, okay, right. So, very interesting world. You want a really like grand visual sense for it. And I think the way to go for it is to make it the next Leica film and have it be stop motion animated. Because I think, A, their films are amazing. They're fantastic. It would be a decent family-friendly film. Like, obviously you have the whole thing of, like, the main character was meant to be a tyrant, but, you know, I think kids are, you know, you can have this guy was a bad man and he did a bad thing and now he's come here and he's, you know, trying to, you know, that's a decent, simple arc for a kid's film.
Kind of like Megamind, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they could really do justice to the interesting designs and stuff like that. And it means that you could bring back Tim Curry to be the voice of evil and Brad Garrett to be the voice of James. The other ones, I don't think they were quite as memorable, but, you know, you could either, so you could either find new interesting people to be them or go back to the original cast, you know, who from memory did a fine enough job.
I've only seen a few clips of the game. And it's one of those things when you look back at an old RTS PC game from like early 2000s and you look at it and think, the fuck is this? I mean, it looks really interesting, but because you don't have that actual connection from the time, especially not playing the game, just watching the footage back, it is very, a bit overwhelming to start with. But as you say, the more you get into it, it seems quite interesting. And I must admit, when you were talking about this, I thought, oh, this could be really difficult to do. But then you said Leica, I think, oh no, I completely understand that. It's a solid shout. That works really well.
Yeah, I think if you tried to do it live action, it would turn into a bit of an over CGI'd mess. And I think this way it still has a physical presence to it. And, you know, you can do bigger things in animation. You can, you know, make it that more otherworldly without it feeling just like characters wandering around in a green screen.
Well, that's the problem with CGI, isn't it? It's always trying to go for photorealism. And as much as I think it's an okay film, Warcraft. Duncan Jones did a great
job. Exactly what I was thinking.
But
yeah.
Fuck me.
It's a sort of not live action, sort of live action adaptation of a
whereas
fantasy
if you go
RTS.
With a,
perfect example.
Yeah, but if you go with an animated film, whether it's either Leica or even like Spider-Man to the Spider-Verse, and you lean into those animated tropes of what you're looking at visually, you don't have to worry about what looks photorealistic. I mean, again, Leica's such a great example because everything they do is beautiful. Doesn't have to look human. And in the sense that you can tell what they are humanoid, same way that Pixar animate their characters. In Coco, for example, I know it's a CGI thing again, but Coco is photorealistic despite the fact that it's a warped shape. So it's going for that unique sort of look and feel. Yeah, it's a good, I could easily work, I think, I hope. It's interesting.
And I'm sure, you know, our comments are probably going to be like 90% people going like, never heard of that one. And then 10% people being like, oh my God, yeah, I remember that. Yeah. And I think it is one of those that, you know, obviously you look back and it's a game from 20 years ago, basically, you know, the polygon count is pretty low on those models. But, you know, certainly playing it back then when it was, you know, cutting edge or whatever, the designs and stuff kind of sparked certainly my imagination so much playing it. And I think, you know, you can go back to, I'm sure they still have the, you know, concept designs kicking around that would be, you know, you could basically just hand them to a bunch of animators and go like, make it like look like we wanted it to if we weren't constrained by technology of the time.
That's kind of made me want to go and play it, actually. I never have.
It's super cheap on Steam.
Ah,
it's like £3.50.
Brought to you by our new sponsors.
I think, like I say, I wanted something that had an interesting world and a fun tone to it. So, that was my selection.
There's also something very important we should point out, that Shiny Entertainment, famously run by the man David Perry, which is the same name as the Norwich Puppet Man. And in my head, I like to imagine that he went mad designing games and now just plays.
I mean, their last game of note, I think, was Enter the Matrix. And I can imagine that would be the kind of experience that would lead you to then just
go crazy
and perform on the streets using puppets.
For the listeners who aren't from Norwich, please Google Norwich Puppet Man and you'll see what we mean.
He's a local treasure.
He is. So segueing away from Norwich Puppet Man, which is basically impossible, I'm going to stick along similar sort of lines to Tim's late 90s, early 2000s with a cool world, cool kind of history thing. And I'm going to talk about the Legacy of Kain series.
Yes. Ooh. Nice.
Yeah, everybody's excited. Because everyone remembers Soul Reaver. That's kind of the big one on the PlayStation that everybody really enjoyed. I actually think Soul Reaver 2 is really good as well, and that's kind of the one where the narrative kind of kicks in a bit more. So I'm going to basically do a film that kind of tells the story of Soul Reaver and Soul Reaver 2. For those of you who don't know, Legacy of Kain is a basically like vampire series that started in the late 90s with the game Blood Omen, which is the story of Kain, who's like one of the original vampires. He starts off, he's resurrected by a necromancer and eventually works his way up through that game, becoming more and more powerful. And vampires in this universe are mental powerful. They turn into lightning, they turn into mist, they're basically werewolves as well for some reason. They can fly, they can jump really high, but they can't fly. Kain himself is the protagonist of the first game, the Blood Omen. And by the end of Blood Omen, Kain makes the choice to kind of be the new tyrant of this world to try and save it and kind of make it better in his image. Of course, surprise, surprise, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and it goes horribly wrong, and he becomes like evil demon lord of the vampires. And the second game, Soul Reaver, which came out in 1999, I believe, is a story of a guy called Raziel, who's his first sired vampire son, and he's like his lieutenant in his army, basically. And throughout the, like, I think he's been in his servitude for like hundreds of years or thousands of years, and Kain's been ruling for thousands of years, and it's been this epic story and epic journey. And Kain always develops a new power so he can turn into lightning, and eventually the other vampires, he teaches them to turn into lightning and stuff. And Soul Reaver starts off with Raziel getting wings, and he's the first vampire to do it. And Kain, being the dick that he is, gets jealous. And the opening cinematic, I advise you, go onto YouTube and watch the Soul Reaver intro, because it's fucking awesome. So Shakespearean and epic and ridiculous.
And metal.
And metal as hell. And basically, Kain rips off his wings and throws Raziel into hell, this like swirling portal into hell. And Raziel eventually comes back and is rejuvenated and reincarnated in this weird, like, ghostly form by this elder god. And the rest of it is kind of his battle of, do I follow the advice of this weird elder god who I don't really know who or what that is or what his motivations are to defeat Kain? And it turns out him and Kain aren't actually on different sides. And there's a whole time travel thing that comes in the second one, and it gets mental. But the story works. And the reason I picked this series is because the gameplay is a bit crap and repetitive, but there's a really good story in there somewhere that I think you could distill out of the shit that surrounds it. And kind of the opposite of what we were saying earlier, of like, it's so difficult to get that really long narrative story, take a 200 hour game and boil it down into 2 hours. I think if you filter out all the crap from Kain and Soul Reaver and stuff, you might actually get maybe a film, maybe two films if I'm feeling cheeky. But yeah, I think you could get a decent sort of two hour 15 film out of Raziel's story, and then him realizing and his journey to redemption against Kain, and then you realize it's also a journey of redemption for Kain as well. And there's Mobius, the time traveling guy, in the second one in Soul Reaver 2. There's Blood Omen 2 later, which is an alternate timeline prequel. Don't ask.
And is that where you can choose between Kain and...
No, that's Defiance. That's the last one, which is also the culmination of the story, sort of, where they battle each other at the end, and it's a whole, your destiny was always locked and you have no choice kind of thing. And it's...
Yeah, because that's great in video games.
Yeah. The decisions you make at the end of each game don't actually influence what's going on in the next ones. And they have this kind of canon that carries through, but there's also constantly, I think it ends up being like 4 different canon timelines that happen with different versions of Kain and different versions of Raziel and blah, 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 blah. It's mental, but I think you could distill it into something that would work.
I think Soul Reaver. I mean, I played those games a lot when I was a teenager, and I fucking...
They seem like very Matthew games.
They are.
Yeah. Early 2000s, like goth metal, vampires and
I
shit.
Had curtains. And no jaw.
Oh, you look like Razzle.
They were the really cool. You're right. Block puzzles were fucking irritating. Legacy of Kain was really fucking annoying, because he's like, it's daytime, I can't do anything. It's like, shit, this is terrible. But the story is wonderful, because it does end with this, I guess, spoilers. Cinematically, it does end really beautifully. Like, he's going to have to not only time travel and kill himself, and then literally turn his own sword on himself in his own physical body. And then he just sinks back into his own hell he started in and thought, fuck? And it's that existential sort of Inception-y kind of the descent ending where you're like, oh, this is grim.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that could work. Really. And again, the world building is really nice. It's all mist and smoke.
And and the world of Nosgoth is like a gothic fantasy, like Tim Burton's wet dream, basically. Yeah. It's like this ridiculous, crazy,
everything
epic.
Underworld wishes it was.
Yeah.
Who do you see as directing, starring, you know?
I think there's a very obvious choice, and I jokingly mentioned this to Matt, like, oh, I might be doing something, and he guessed what I was doing, and it's Guillermo del Toro. It's got to be. I'm going for that kind of... He made Hellboy work, and that has that, holy shit, there's suddenly loads of demons, and it's interacting with... Because a big part of the Soul Reaver games is there's a spectral realm and a physical realm, and Raziel can't die because he's already dead. He's like a revenant, basically. So he travels backwards and forwards between these things as you die. And you can consciously do that to like travel through a gate that isn't there in the spectral realm and all that kind of stuff. And I think Del Toro's mind for that weird visual style and having a really distinct spectral realm, physical realm, he loves Lovecraft, like going all weird Elder God shit and stuff like that, I think would just work really well. And... yeah, and there was basically no one else I thought of that could really do it justice.
Because obviously, and the acting as well is very tricky because, as you said before, it's very Shakespearean.
Oh, it's so incredibly...
It's very theatrical.
The voice acting is fantastic.
It is.
And loads of it is really kind of like you said, Matt, really existential and eloquent and stuff. And it's never like, ah, you and me, we must fight to the death. It's like, ah, must our eternal souls truly battle one more time, Raziel? Yeah. We've done this for millennia, my dear friend. And all this like really ridiculous, like campy Shakespearean stuff.
It's like the dude who plays, I can't remember the guy who voices Raziel, but kept saying, vampire! And it's like, yes. You got Tony Jay as the voice of the Elder God.
Oh,
like
Tony Jay,
wonderful role
the Elder
voice,
God,
just,
yeah.
So it's very difficult. I can't even think who would cast with that one. It'd be so difficult.
So for the Elder God, you mentioned it just be voice acting, because I don't know how you play a, you know, a 10,000 mile long celestial squid. I'm going for the voice of Jeremy Irons.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's got enough gravitas and enough like, arise, Raziel.
Yeah.
That kind of like that vocal fry at the end there you need to kind of convey.
That was practically Ian McDiarmid.
Oh, I mean...
Revenge of the Sith.
You're welcome.
Rise, Vader.
I was an octave lower, but
yeah. It's a good shout, though. I like Ryan's. I would have gone Rickman if he wasn't dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rickman was my thinking as well. And I saw a few. I was seeing like, oh, have people already done this idea? A few people had, and Rickman was the top of people's list about 10 years ago. And I was like, oh man, that would have been good. For Kane, this was the hardest one for me to cast, and I went back and forth with a few different people. I think Ralph Fiennes might be making a good Kane. He's quite Shakespearean, channels some of his Voldemort kind of weird mannerisms, and he's got that kind of... Because Kane is like this... I'd have to redesign the character because he's basically dressed like Sean Connery from Zardos at that point.
He's
like,
he is,
he's got just a shoulder cape and like a bandolier across his chest and then trousers, and then the rest of him is like just sinew and muscle and like this weird grey... I don't know how I'm doing that, but and Ray Fiennes is not.
Have you seen Coriolanus?
No, I haven't.
Coriolanus, Shakespearean adaptation of Coriolanus, directed and starring Ray Fiennes, and he's quite menacing. But he's just a shaved head Roman in that film, but contemporary setting. But yeah, he's quite menacing. Yeah. Blood all over his face. I think that could work.
Yeah, that jumped to mind when you mentioned Ray Fiennes of Voldemort, and then that Shakespeare. Yeah. It's my primary, like, I'm sure he's done other Shakespeare, but yeah, he's so good in that. So
also he's a fucking Nazi in Schindler's List.
He can do evil. Yeah, he can totally do evil. And for Raziel, I was thinking kind of younger. Unfortunately, it's going to be a film full of like young British or like British actors, basically.
Scarlett Johansson.
But digitally replaced with because you said the main character of Raziel is missing his lower jaw, so it's kind of difficult to do that. I was going to go for Tom Hiddleston. I think he's lanky enough. He's kind of weird enough. He could be a kind of you get the cool vampire scenes. You get the revenant scenes. I think he would kind of work.
He also brings in the audience.
And that brings in the ladies. Ladies love a bit of gothic Tom Hiddleston.
So the character design, so yeah, Kane was that kind of Eric of Melner Bone kind of...
Yeah, very much so, yeah, very much Elric, yeah.
But Razzle, yeah, because he was like a purple guy with glowing eyes, literally no jaw.
No jaw,
like
has a big scarf.
Yeah, rubber scarf he'd like pull out and suck souls.
Suck souls,
in.
Yeah.
So would he be CG?
I don't know. That's something I haven't...
If you think Crimson Peak, Del Toro took a lot of visual makeup stuff and then enhanced it with a bit of CGI on top of it.
Wonder how many times I can squeeze Doug Jones in there as various different creepy vampire monsters and stuff. But yeah, I would think Del Toro would probably go a bit more practical. Like, he made the bloody Gill Man from Shape of Water kind of believable. Yeah, and that's really lanky and weird and kind of like...
And with the scarf around the mouth, you could do...
He's missing his jaw, but it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
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 Hang on, the mouth is covered. Have you considered Tom Hardy?
Kane.
My brother! My father!
Oh, he never used the same voice twice. He'll be doing an impression of Sue Pollard for the whole film.
Jesus Christ. So, yeah, my pitch is Legacy of Kane, and I think it'd be a ridiculous kind of fantasy gothic romp. I'm worried it would end up a bit like Underworld. You're kind of hinted at that, Matt. I'm hoping it'll be Underworld, but good, because those films got bad very quickly. So let's transition, shall we, from Legacy of Kane to something a little bit different. Matthew Stogden.
Let's get away from all these kind of 2000s PlayStation 1 era games. What have you got for us, Matthew?
I think you'll find it's a PlayStation 1 game from 1998. Oh. That's
my series started in 1996.
I mean, that's on brand. So I'm going to go with specifically the first Tenchu games, Tenchu Stealth Assassins, which is a game about technically one of two ninjas, sort of. From the...
What a good start with. Technically, one of two people, sort of.
Well, it's you play the exact same story as two different characters, but I'm going to merge it into one story.
Not Resident Evil 2, but not.
Kind of, actually. Good answer, yeah. So there are two separate ninjas, Rikimaru and Ayame, and they both work for Lord Goda, who is a noble lord in sort of feudal Japan. And then there is an evil sorcerer called Lord Mayo, which, as an Irishman, Delicious. Mayo is a county, not an evil lord.
Oh, I was thinking the condiment, but...
No, even then, Mayo is a county before it's a condiment. but basically, yeah, so he summons this demon or demonic being called the Onikage, who goes around and just disrupts things. And you have to sort of, I think it's 10 levels, and you work through, stealthy way through the levels with incredibly low, shallow sort of depth of field of where you can actually see things. It's very, very difficult, but very, very fucking fun. And
so you said it's the most grounded.
I'm not
the bad guy is an evil sorcerer who summons demon.
I'm getting there. And
it was all a dream.
It was all a dream in the shower. And you go through these 10 levels and, you know, kill a bad guy as you go climb a tower, sort of Game of Death style in a weird way. And you finally get to the final boss and he is the sorcerer himself. Simple as that. Now, the reason it's quite grounded, in my opinion, is that I would... Again, if we do the classic sort of sequelizers thing, I would say if I was releasing this, it'd be 2005, personally, just because I wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would get Takashi Miike to do this. And the reason I think it's good, because he's done quite a few very visceral, gory sort of films. The sort of Black Society trilogy, and he's done Audition, Ichi the Killer, but also then he's done more period films of late, like 13 Assassins and Harakiri is a very good remake. But more importantly... Of late, especially, he's done JoJo's Bizarre Adventure and Ace Attorney. So he's done a video game film that's actually quite good, apparently. But then it's also an incredibly faithful adaptation. So it's very cartoony and very ridiculous and very, very silly.
So is it an adaptation of a particular Ace Attorney thing?
I don't know if it is a specific game as it is. Right, more just I think it's another installment, as it were, another Phoenix Wright-esque escapade. But he has experience with doing that, and he's very much about a loyal adaptation of the visuals and the casting, etc. As Rikimaru, who is the main ninja, sort of white-haired assassin, quite honourable and a bit jaded, big scar down his face, I'd go Taro Yamamoto, who is one of the older kids from Battle Royale. He also was in Izo, which is directed by Miike. I think about 2004. So they'd worked with each other before. And again, very talented, very sort of stoic look to his face. And he's also, again, sort of because of Battle Royale's popularity around that point, known to an American audience as well. So that would be, again, something we'd work on. Also from Battle Royale, to play Ayami, we go Ko Shibasaki, who was in, again, Battle Royale. She's also in Go with Yamamoto. And she's in 47 Ronin recently with, fairly recently, Keanu. With Keanu Reeves, yeah. not a good film as an example, but
well,
she's in it.
That was a film that exists.
Yeah. So I would completely change the character, though, because in the game you can alternate between the two different ninjas. And Rikimaru is really interesting and, you know, reasonably well developed. He helps a character commit seppuku at one point. So it's all very honorific. Whereas Ayami's a bit of an asshole. It's just this sassy kid, and she just taunts everyone and is quite painful. I don't know if it's because it's lost in translation. Also, the fucking voice acting is atrocious. But we could work that character into something, you know, just a bit more interesting and have them work as a bit of a dynamic, doing an offer missions and as a thing. Lord Goda, I'd have Koji Yakusho, who was in Memoirs of a Geisha and Babel and 13 Assassins again with and Harakiri, Mikio things, being, you know, an honourable feudal lord who would train these kids, and you got again a bit of a father-son, father-daughter kind of motif going on, so that's quite nice. And the only Kage Lord Mayo thing, I was going to go with Hiroyuki Sanada, solely because I love Hiroyuki Sanada. He's in things like Message from Space, which Stuart and I have seen. It's the Star Wars film from Japan that is not the Star Wars, and no, it's ridiculous. But that's not what he's known for. He's in the original Ring. He's in The Last Samurai, Sunshine, 47 Ronin.
Oh, again, that guy. Yeah, Sunshine, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's fucking amazing. I love him as an actor. I think he's great. But I like the idea of not only the only Kage is this sort of a demonic presence, but him and Mayo being the same actor, so that you could have him being like a demonic, you know.
Okay.
But in terms of the actual structure of the story, it's literally just some ninjas running around Japan, offing a load of local lords, and then finally getting to the sorcerer who's conjured this. And again, I should say the demonic sort of person is just a guy. He doesn't really have a lot of magical powers. It's only when you get to the final battle that it becomes a bit more Big Trouble in Little China with lightning and a flaming sword and a big fiery cult and all that sort of stuff. And sort of like it does have a sort of range into horror elements where you've got lots of fire breathing ghouls and shit like that. But again, I think it's quite a straightforward story and something that I think Japan probably would and could. I had to, before I went, oh, this is a great idea, I'll go with this, and then thought, hang on, have they already done this and I just haven't noticed? And there's a few sort of obviously similar sort of releases, lots of semi-supernatural feudal sort of things going on, but yeah, I think that's quite easy to do. And because you've got a few games there, you could got a few bit sequels you could do or just develop on, because I think Tenchu 2 is a prequel, so I wouldn't worry about that too much. But yeah, I think it's a solid and easy, if I'm honest, pick. But again, because I wouldn't say, oh, what's that, a Japanese game, get me Scarlett Johansson. So yeah,
all the characters
for everybody,
so even the water, every single actor played by Scarlett Johansson.
So what are you changing about the dynamic between the two original characters?
Well, that's the thing. There is no dynamic between the originals.
That's what I mean. Are you, if you're having them in there at the same time, what's the difference between them?
I think you can add a lot of interesting
sexual tension.
Give
the audience what they want, Matthew.
I mean, you could probably infuse that, but I think mostly just some brother and sister stuff going on. The fact that they're both trained by this specific feudal lord. Again, that is actually developed in the prequel, in a bit, in Tenchu 2. Just because it's the idea of those two competing for attention sort of thing, and also you can have them sort of saving each other. I think it could be a nice buddy film without tripping over each other too much. You wouldn't have to worry about dividing too many times. You just have them go on separate missions and then meeting up at the end for a final thing. I think it could work quite easily.
So firstly, I'd just like to point out that after all these years, I've only just realised that Onikage is literally demon ninja.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on board as long as Onikage A has his theme tune, which is amazing.
I point out that the music in fucking Tenchu is astonishingly good.
It really fucking is, amazing, isn't it? And secondly, he's still got to have that weird thing where his only armour is on his shins, and he blocks every move with his shins. Yeah. By lifting his leg up really high and blocking swords, which is amazing.
You'd think it was like some sort of glitch in the game, but it's not.
No, I'd love to see that live action, actually. Somebody doing that would be
impressive. I think, okay, if you have a good stunt team, you could do that quite easily.
But of course, the big question, Will you have the original shuriken in it, or will they be replaced by kunai knives in order to bring back the British classification problems at the time?
Again, for a Japanese audience, I don't think they care. So I think they'd go shuriken or kunai. Actually, I'd say fuck it, go everything, because it's 2005, we've got Naruto audience now. So they're used to these things, and they're getting more soft with it, I think. So I think, yeah, do everything, and do it right for Japan, and then let the world figure out what they want to do with it. Is my opinion.
Don't replace them with sausages like in Ninja Turtles 2.
Sausages or walkie-talkies?
That's sausages up close, walkie-talkies for a distance.
Yes. So that's my shout, Jack. Hope you liked it.
Loved it.
Mm.
I'm a big weeboo. Love it.
Good.
So let's transition over to the man who will take us home for this episode. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Stuart Ashen.
So, interestingly, mine comes from the same company that now owns the rights to Tenchu. Mm. Although I believe they've never done anything with it, really. So well, this is...
Well,
the...
they might be.
Mm. Yeah, well, maybe. Mm. Yeah.
Now. Sort of, maybe.
Yeah, who knows, who knows. So this is, weirdly for me, by far the most recent game. And
nobody was expecting that from you, Stuart. That's, we've all picked much older games.
It is odd, isn't it? It really is odd.
Everyone's expecting some dark retro game from like the 80s.
I mean, my first pick was Superman 64, but as many of you will know, I have actually sold that screenplay to DC Comics. It's literally a napkin with "he flies through rings and it is foggy" written on it. And apparently I beat out all the other scripts.
So that's what Man of Steel was based on.
It's pretty much a direct sequel. We are copying a lot of the story beats, to be fair.
His dad is killed by weather.
Yeah, no, it's just by a ring this time. They don't even explain why he's alive again. He respawned. So yeah, this is Bloodborne by FromSoft. Probably, or FromSoftware, I suppose, even their full name. It's probably my favouritest game ever. So it's kind of an odd sidestep from the Dark Souls series, where it takes over a lot of the game mechanics, but it's faster paced, has transforming weapon mechanics and things. But more importantly, it's not in one of these fantasy worlds. It's in a different fantasy world, a sort of Victorian England type of thing, or pre-Victorian England, maybe?
It's like Edwardian, I think.
Yeah, Edwardian is probably a better shout, I would have said, yeah. But things are so fucked up in it, it's hard to tell. So I'll spoil this a little bit, but hey, the game's been out years, and it was free on PlayStation Plus.
Yeah, if you haven't played Bloodborne by now, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, come on, guys. Come on. Come on. Although now I feel bad because it is the most recent game. Anyway, play it anyway, it's good. So the idea behind it is the protagonist... So as it is, because it's always a very blank slate, is some sort of foreigner who's gone to this town of Yharnam in order to have a special type of blood transfusion to cure some ailment, which is never made in any way clear what that is. It seems to go badly for him because he passes out, has a very weird vision about werewolves catching fire as they attempt to kill him and little monsters everywhere, wakes up, realises that the person administering the blood is gone, everything is empty except for an actual werewolf, which rips him, well, to fucking pieces, basically, because it's too hard for you to beat at the start of the game. But rather than dying, he goes to this place called the Hunter's Dream, where he is fitted with weapons and a bit of armour, and they're like, well, you're a hunter now. He's like, what? Just wanted some blood. No, no, you're a hunter now. And if you don't help us hunt and kill all the beasts that infect Yharnam every so often, you'll just keep dying, coming back here forever. And the hunt must finish before the dawn will rise. And nobody really explains particularly what's going on, although I should point out it has a much more traditional narrative than something like Dark Souls. You can actually piece all this one together, whereas Dark Souls is more sort of deliberately ambiguous. But so I'm pretty much convinced you couldn't really do it justice, but I would really like to see somebody try. I mean, they've tried more traditional narrative stuff with it in comics, which I don't think really worked quite when you sort of focus on the minutiae of it. Because the whole point of the game is basically the people in the town are slowly turning into werewolf things and you have to kill them all, except it turns into something way beyond that, as you discover actually the werewolf is just a small facet, almost like a side effect of this body known as the Healing Church, which is using the blood and stuff that they've got from Lovecraftian creatures to try and evolve past humanity. Yes. And as you go along, it gets more and more extreme to the end.
Them trying to ascend as gods, essentially. This is become
exactly
elder gods.
It, yes, and they've managed to construct sort of extra dimensional spaces, and there's all sorts of little
you literally fight elder gods, and there's a whole kind of like the concept of life and death and birth, and birth and the birth of children is a big thing. And
it's a
huge kind of concept. And even massive spoilers for Bloodborne, the ending ends with a birth in a way, in that kind
it
of
can
the,
do
the,
yes one of the three endings
if you do the right thing and I'm trying not to spoil it, kill the right person and have the correct final boss and do all the things. Stuart knows what I'm talking about.
I do.
And yeah, it's a real kind of, I can see what you mean, that it would be really difficult to do justice, but it's one of the most interesting lores and mythologies. And I tried to play Dark Souls before and I was like, this is cool, but I'm not getting sucked in. And then Bloodborne, I played it a little bit, funnily, at our friend Ben Allen's. And I was like, this is really cool. I'm going to pick this up eventually. I ended up borrowing it from him and just completely getting drawn in and being like, this world is insane. The visual style of it. And then when you realize it's all Elder God stuff, which is much later on, and there's just a giant ball of eyes that is dangling from a ceiling and drops into
the brain of Mensis.
You go, the brain of Mensis. And fuck me, that's a weird... Yeah. It gets weird and fucked up. And the amygdala realm thing.
Oh my God.
If you haven't played Bloodborne, this means nothing to any of you.
But. It sounds cool.
Yeah. It's words.
I got a quick question. Someone who hasn't played it loosely familiar with the idea of Bloodborne. Mm-hmm. So you're saying about obviously it'd be not nigh on impossible, but very, very difficult to achieve.
Yeah.
May I put it to you then, rather than being... I don't think we should say, make a TV series. I assume you'd have to do it as a filmed back-to-back Lord of the Rings trilogy style.
No, I don't think you would.
Oh, really?
I think you could concentrate. It'd be sort of over the 2.5, maybe towards 2.5. Well,
films,
maybe towards 2.5
films
hours.
Can be.
That's why I was thinking for Legacy of Kain. So,
Yeah, I think it could be done. The thing you've got to preserve is this sense of sort of confusion and mystery.
Okay.
As opposed to just, here's a load of monsters and kill them. I mean, that's got to be in there. It's got to be visceral.
I wonder if it gets in the hands of Hollywood, it would just be like, here's all the answers.
So, yeah.
Ta-da, no ambiguity. Ta-da.
This is it. You've got to get over
the ambiguity.
Yes, you've got to get over the fact that the main character basically is completely alone, and they're sort of confused and crying and getting bits of information from people. You want minimal expository dialogue. So I was thinking a bit like Stalker, the old Tartovsky film.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's a bit too sort of empty, because you've got the action and the stuff going on.
On a similar line, then, I'd recommend Quarren. Alfonso Cuarón.
I thought Alfonso Cuarón early on, but no.
Yeah.
Something has completely pushed me over to...
Oh, yes?
Robert Eggers.
Oh, shit.
From The Witch.
Yes.
Because he's done The Witch, his short films in the past have gone this, and his next film, The Lighthouse, is on this sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a big mystery, isn't it? But it's like the tiny bits that are out sound fascinating.
Absolutely, yes, and black and white and that kind of thing.
So, pure atmosphere as well. So
there was an actual quote that I saw that absolutely sold me on this. This is from the film critic Leslie Coffin talking about The Witch and saying they shouldn't have marketed it as a horror film. They shouldn't have had a horror film trailer because, well, to quote, the less you know about this movie, the better your experience will be. But everyone who saw it opening weekend probably walked in with too much knowledge and hype to really get as much out of it as they could have if the film had the veil of mystery for them.
Mm.
And like, that's it. Mm. That's description of The Witch is exactly what you would need from this.
Yes.
And also, most importantly, of course, Eggers, due to his surname, sounds like he's got a playground nickname already, which is hilarious.
That is the most important thing for a director.
An on-set name,
All the football chants you can have. Eggers, oi, 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 every time he's on set. Amazing. So, and the music you've got almost in the bag, because Bloodborne has a fantastic soundtrack, particularly the expansion. Something else, I wouldn't want any super well-known actors in it. You don't want a Tom Cruise in it or anything. You want people most you would vaguely...
Him doing his run down the streets of Old Yharnam, just like,
with his giant Cuban heels.
And his whip cane thing.
And everybody else standing in a ditch.
Yep.
And looking through the actors that From Software frequently use in Dark Souls, Bloodborne, etc., there are a load of small part actors who you sort of recognise, but wouldn't necessarily, you know, come up with. Jenny Funnell, Alan Cordiner, Stephen Elliott, Wildum Vanderpugh, Connor Byrne, Daniel Flynn, and the brilliantly named Pookie Quesnel, which is one of my favourite names.
Pookie Quesnel. But I've no idea who that is, but that's the best name I've ever heard.
That is amazing, isn't it? And for the sort of, if you do want a few faces, you've got Peter Serafinowicz.
That was going to be my invention,
Yeah, Ruth Negga is in Dark Souls 2, and Hannah John Kamen was in 2 as well, as a talking cat.
Interesting.
Inexplicably. But so they're in there if you want a little bit. If you really need some sort of known face with gravitas, get Willem Dafoe in. Maybe as German the First Hunter.
Yeah, he'd make a good
And he's in The Lighthouse.
Yeah.
So,
you've got the connection already. There,
So, I'm not entirely sure it could be done justice to, but I think that team would do the best job of it, and I'd be very interested to see it, and probably very disappointed and pissed off by it, because the problem is, if it's your favourite thing, you do not suffer any errors, you know.
That's why I didn't pick Bioshock.
And Assassin's Creed already been done perfectly, right, Matt?
So yeah.
Got nothing to...
Moving on.
No problems there.
Moving on.
Who'd you cast? Michael Fassbender. Doesn't matter.
Moving on.
Sorted. No problems with that film.
Nope. I mean, there are, but not worry. We're not talking about it. There's no time. There's no time. We've run out of time, listeners.
Run out of time for the, myriad problems with the Assassin's Creed.
Three problems. Hit Matt up on Twitter if you want to know more about his thoughts on Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, I'll fucking tell you.
Don't. Don't. For therein lies madness.
Much the madness like of Matthew Stockton.
The madman's insight. You have consumed too much.
Ah, yes. Mm. Exactly. So, yeah, that is some video games we'd like to see turned into films. Do you have any suggestions, listeners? Please let us know. I'm sure there's plenty of ones. Do you think there's been any good ones? Because we don't. Is there a good one we haven't heard of somehow that we don't know about? So, yeah, if you have any suggestions, ladies and gentlemen, please tweet at us.
I'm pretty sure I was just say The Last of Us and keep screaming at us all over and
over.
The
Last of Us!
The Last of Us!
It's already a film, shut up. We're at Sequelizers on Twitter, Sequelizers on all the social medias and all that good stuff.
Are we on Bumble?
We're on Bumble, we're on Grindr.
We're on Habbo Hotel.
Habbo Hotel! Yeah. That's a fucking callback.
We're on Sony Friend Factory, something so obscure. You couldn't even connect to it through a website, you had to download a client.
I thought we should be on Airbnb.
I mean, if you want to come sleep in the Sequelizer space.
We recorded your house, Matt. You could do that.
I mean, it's possible, but also, fuck no! Also, they'd have to sit there and explain to them why Assassin's Creed is actually right. They'd leave fast. And
you don't have to pay, you just have to listen to Matt pitch Assassin's Creed films.
I have to watch you watch films.
In order to judge you as an appropriate housemate. So on that note, thank you, Stuart, for being part of the Sequelizers, and hopefully we'll have
you
back on in the future.
Thank you for this opportunity to talk shit.
To pick a modern video game franchise and disappoint your audience. Oh, Stuart's full of shit old games that you'll turn into.
Eric and the Floaters, the movie. Chubby Gristle, the movie.
Exactly. You went critically acclaimed, one of the best games of the last ever, Bloodborne. And you're like, oh. I want a worst game ever turned into a best film ever, Stuart.
Squidge the movie just wouldn't work.
Squidge the movie. Oh, dear. And thank you, listeners, for listening. And the rest of us, we'll catch you very soon.
Season 4 cometh.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel-Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.